Saturday, April 5th, 2025, post-winter retreat period. So transitioning back into the time of the year when we have guests coming and going from the monastery, and some of the retreat crew is still here. So it's great. This is like a big family and a good feeling. We've got quite a community here, and we're starting to have more monastic guests. We'll have Ajahn Kachana joining us before too long, and a number of other Abhayagiri bhikkhus, ajahns, kind of more of the younger than Longpor Pasano and Longpor Amaro generation. I don't know if I can say the younger generation, maybe the younger than Longpor Pasano, Longpor Amaro generation, my generation, and Ajahn Chinda's generation, and around Ajahn Sudhiro's generation, and so the number of ajahns and bhikkhus visiting us. And we had our Sangapala board meeting this afternoon, which is very nice. Very nice to see old friends. Nice to see Debbie here. She had been here since December. And just Hugh and Sumi and then the other board members online, and just people who really look after things behind the scenes at Abhayagiri. And it takes a lot. It takes a lot to keep this ship going. It takes a whole crew to keep it going. It takes a whole team to keep it running. And it makes me think of this teaching of the older generation of Krupa Ajahns. They wouldn't talk about that they wouldn't consider that necessarily that the senior monk or the monk that is running the monastery is the abbot. They wouldn't really consider it that way. They would say, Tukru Ben Jawa Wat. So everybody's the abbot. Everyone's the abbot. So everyone plays their part. Everyone has a sense of ownership. Everyone has stock in this place, and everyone contributes in their own way. And then, as Ajahn Amaro would like to say, Abhayagiri, what is Abhayagiri? Is it the land? Is it the place? But actually, no, it's the people who are here. Whether we're staying here for a day, a few days, a week, a month, a year, 2 years, or 10 years, or even a lifetime, then whoever is here at any given moment, that makes up the Abhayagiri community. This is the post-retreat period, so we'll be saying hello to some new people, newcomers, and then saying goodbye to some people who've been here for a period of time. So it's a time of coming and going, and then there's that we might feel the pangs of separation, and there's a saying in Thai also that we come together to separate. So not necessarily looking at the angle of that all coming together ends in separation, but that we come together for the sake of separation, because any coming together actually ends in separation. Any coming together, any arising, it ends in ceasing. It has to be that way. If there is arising, there has to be ceasing. So that's this insight that we're looking for. If there is arising, there has to be ceasing. There can't just be arising. There can't just be ceasing. If there is arising, there has to be ceasing. If something begins, it has to end at some point. And if we're meditating and we start to feel peaceful, we should see why is that. There's this interesting phenomenon that happens in the mind where maybe we get irritated and angry. So if there's irritation and anger, since when has it been good? It's never been good. It's never felt good. It always feels better to not have irritation and anger in the mind. There's never any time when irritation and anger has felt better than non-irritation, non-anger. It's always better. It's always better to not have it. So why do we still do it? Or if there's greed or attachment, strong attachment, longing in the mind, in the heart, and then there's an absence of that longing, that greed, that attachment, it's always better when it's absent. When the longing is absent, when there's just peace in the moment, it's always better when the sense of passion or longing is absent. So why do we do it? So it's good to start to investigate these things. Why do we do it? These are habits. These are habit patterns, and they're built up over a very, very long period of time. And they're habits because at some point, maybe because there wasn't mindfulness or there was a lack of circumspection or wisdom that noticed the results of these things, there was a false sense that it gave us some sort of happiness, some sort of charge. From the irritation and anger, there was some sort of sense that it gave us a temporary sense of happiness or a charge or a sense of fleeting fulfillment that got us addicted to it. From passion, longing, attachment, there was a temporary sense of fulfillment. There was a charge that we got from it that because of a lack of mindfulness, we didn't notice what happens after. We didn't notice the suffering that comes after. So our mind the heart is almost hardwired just to see the arising of things and not to look at the ceasing of things. Of course, when things cease, then we end up getting lost in suffering. And when there's a marriage that ends in divorce and litigation and lawsuits, how awful that can be. But we didn't think about that at the beginning. We weren't thinking that that's the way it would go. Or if you have children and they're just really wonderful at first and then they grow up and then they choose paths in life that we wouldn't approve of, that they bring suffering and torment to themselves, and then that can bring suffering and torment to the parents. And it's not, you know, we want them to do good for themselves, and then they choose not to. When the children become independent, they choose a path that they torment themselves, and then that torments the parents, so we don't want that. There's nothing we can do. But at the beginning, we didn't think about that. We only saw the really good, happy aspect of that, but we didn't think of the way it could go. We didn't think that it could go the way of suffering. Or even when we just get something good, we get a new job, we don't think of the possibility of losing it. We don't think of the possibility of getting laid off. We might just be elated that we got that job in the moment, but it could be a week, a month, a year. Maybe that job is no longer available or we get laid off. But we didn't think about that in the beginning. We only saw the arising. So when we undertake Buddhist practice and Buddhist meditation, we try to train ourselves with mindfulness to see that anytime there's any kind of arising, then just to caution ourselves that this is going to end at some point, and then we're more prepared for it. And so the suffering won't hit us as hard if we prepare ourselves like that. And it's not just a Buddhist practice that we take on, but this is really the way things are. It's not just that we're doing it because the Buddha said that we should do this, or we're not just thinking that anytime there's arising, there's a passing away just because maybe somebody told us to think like that. But if we investigate with mindfulness, then we'll see that that really is the way things are. Anytime anything arises, it really will pass away sooner or later. It just has to be that way. It's just the natural order of things. And it's sad. This is what the Buddha called dukkha. This is suffering. It is sad. It's sad to age and grow old. It's sad to die. All of these things are sad. The word in Pali for sad is somanasa. Or sorry, that's happiness. But domanasa. Somanasa is glad. Domanasa is sad. But when somanasa changes, it changes to domanasa. So all of these things, when we feel happy and glad and elated at things, maybe we've acquired some sort of inheritance or won the lottery, hit the jackpot, then we might feel elated and glad. But then that changes, or it might even be the cause of more suffering. We inherit all the money, so then angry heirs and relatives and debtors, they come after us, and then our life is in danger. This happens all the time. I'm sure every single one of us in this room, or at least almost every single one of us, could think of examples of people we know, friends, relatives, who have had just the most horrible, or even ourselves maybe, have just the kind of most horrible experiences with litigation and angry ex-partners. I have an aunt who was going through this for a long time, just years and years of just acrimonious litigation, just so sad. And when people don't really think about Dhamma, don't have any foundation for the heart, don't have any refuge, that's how it will be. Just get what you can, take what you can. It's a dog-eat-dog world. That's how it'll be if we don't have this faith in Kamma or the foundation of Dhamma. So that brings us to this idea of refuge. And we chanted the three refuges and the eight precepts this evening. And by the way, for those of you who might be new, this is not a lifetime commitment to the eight precepts. It's just a one-day commitment, and it follows the tradition in Thailand where the male and female devotees, laymen, laywomen, would come to the monastery, and they would undertake the eight precepts in the morning time. So here at Abhayagiri, it's just sort of a nod to that. We do it in the evening time, so some of you may have eaten dinner right before taking the eight precepts, and that's fine. But it's an acknowledgement that at least for today or tonight, you'll be following these precepts. And in Thailand, it's really wonderful that lay people will practice through the day. And sometimes they'll take a nap in the afternoon preparing for the all-night sit, for the all-night meditation vigil, which, by the way, this evening it's going to be optional. It's not mandatory right now. And then they practice with the monastic community. That's what we call Wan Prat. So Prat is the word for monk, meaning venerable. It literally means excellent. Wan Prat is like the monk day or the excellent day that the lay people observe. And in the northeast of Thailand, even now, perhaps it's changing a little bit, but it's the weekend for the farmers. Their whole week is really around the monastery and around the Wan Prat and around going and practicing with the monastic community. And these lay people have so much faith. It's so inspiring. It's one of the things I love and miss about Thailand is some of these old, we call it in the Isan, we call Ma'ok, Ma'ok, Pa'ok. It's like a out mother, out father, or like they're the mothers and fathers who are looking after the community. So it's like that sense of family coming into it again. And some of these Ma'ok, they're really tough. These old ladies going and practicing in the monastery, they stay up all night meditating. It's really impressive. And for the monks, it's a good teaching. And, remember Katina season in Thailand, and when I was living at Phujamkom out in Ubon, Ratchathani, and Upper Kongchiam on the Mekong River, and just a little branch of Wat Phananachat. And we had a Katina that year, and then so also a few of us would go around and to these little Wat Nongpapong branch monasteries that were nearby and attend their Katinas, and they would normally have all-night Dhamma talks at their Katina ceremony. And so I remember going to this Wat Ba Nongkung near Wat Phujamkom. It was this monk Longpa Tawin, and just going, and I was actually not quite an Ajahn at the time, but I was senior enough, they asked me to give a talk, but I gave a talk really late at night because I was one of the more junior talk-giving monks. And my talk was like 12:30 or 1 a.m., something like that. And I just had to kind of wait until they asked me to get up on the Dhamma seat, give a talk in Thai. And so as I was kind of sitting there and a number of Thai Ajahns were giving talks, then slowly people were kind of getting up and leaving and going to take a bit of a rest. But there was this one old laywoman there, and not only did she stay the whole time, but she had her hands in Anjali through every talk. She never took her hands out of Anjali. She just kind of, every single talk, the whole talk, she just kept her hands in Anjali. And she had her hands like that in Anjali all night. She sat there all night with her hands in Anjali. Just thought, so much faith, so inspiring. So that's when we take refuge. refuge in Sangha. It's a place of safety, but it's also a place that we have faith, confidence, and trust in. I like to translate the word sadha, which is normally translated as faith, sadha as trust or confidence. So that what do we trust in? What do we trust in? What do we have faith in? What do we have confidence in? And so that refuge in Sangha, if there's that trust in Sangha, and the trust in Buddha, the Buddha is the awareness, the Butoh, the one who knows. So if we have faith, confidence, and trust in that, then that's a refuge. We can rely on it. A refuge is something we can rely on. It's a place of safety. It's a place we can always go to. It's a place that'll never disappoint us. So that sense of awareness in the moment, if we're able to tap into that, that's not going to disappoint us. We tap into Butoh and we're able to be with the awareness in the present. We're able to be the one who knows in the present. It might occur to us, how could I have gotten irritated? How could I have gotten angry? How could I have had longing and passion? This is peaceful. This is really good. This is really worthy of giving importance to. And the Dhamma, the refuge of Dhamma, the truth of the way things are. And this is we have the Dhamma teachings, that would be the external Dhamma, but then the internal Dhamma would just be the way it is, the way things are, the natural order of things. So we talk about trust, and confidence. And this is something we can't force. You can't force somebody to have sadha. You can't make somebody to trust. Trust comes about naturally when we see things that inspire faith, confidence, and trust in us. So when we hear teachings that we find useful, we'll develop a sense of trust, a sense of confidence. When we see somebody's conduct, say we have a Dhamma friend who has good conduct, their sila is very pure, they're keeping their precepts very purely, they're very honest and have a sense of integrity in their life, then that can develop a sense of trust and confidence. That's sadha. We can trust in that. It's these precepts, they're all about developing trust. When we don't steal, for example, the second precept, not taking what is not given, that means not stealing. When we don't steal, then we have integrity. People trust us. When we follow that for a long time, people can develop a strong sense of trust in us, and we can develop a strong sense of trust in ourselves. When we don't commit, in the A precepts, it's, say, celibacy, not engaging in any intentional sexual activity. If one follows the five precepts, just your average Buddhist householder would follow the five precepts, which would be not engaging in any sexual misconduct. Even that just develops such strong trust. And of course, the fourth precept, not lying, not engaging in false speech, not being deceitful, you know, being straightforward, having a sense of honesty and integrity with our actions and our speech. And that followed for a long time, we'll go inward. It will go inward to a sense that we won't lie to ourselves. We'll be very honest and straightforward with ourselves. That's a higher level of that precept when we take it inward. And then when we're honest and straightforward in our speech, then people will trust us. That's just the natural result. That's kamma. Kamma is the natural result, the natural order of things. And kamma isn't just bad. There's bad and good kamma. And for, say, if we were to tell a lie, we would consider that bad kamma, because the very definition of bad kamma is it would result in suffering. The very definition of good kamma is it results in happiness. And then any good kamma that we do, it has to result in happiness. It can't be any other way. If we make good kamma, that particular action has to result in happiness. Suffering won't come from that action. If suffering comes, it was from some other action committed either before or after that. If we create bad kamma, say we tell a lie or we steal or we kill, then the result of that action has to come back to us. It's just the natural order of things. If we lie or steal or kill and we get some sort of happiness, that happiness came from some other kamma. It wasn't from that. it wasn't from the lying, stealing, killing, sexual misconduct, and so on. So it's a little bit tricky because of these time lags. So this is where trust comes in. This is where the trust in the Buddha's teachings come in. There has to be that sense of trust at first, and we're going to have almost, it's not confirmed yet, it's unconfirmed faith. It's not blind faith, because we might be able to see already a little bit that we can see around us. We look around us with mindfulness and we see in ourselves that, yeah, these things, when followed, do lead to happiness, and these other things, when followed, do lead to suffering. I can more or less see that for myself, but I don't yet see it clearly. So because we don't yet see it clearly, there does have to be that sense of trust in the Buddha's teachings, things we haven't yet confirmed. But we've seen enough to be able to trust. So we've seen enough that we ought to trust the teachings. And sometimes we might feel we've seen enough that we don't want to trust anymore and go somewhere else. We might feel, okay, I've seen enough. I don't have trust in that anymore. I don't have trust in that teacher anymore, or I don't have trust in this place anymore. And that's also just a natural result. You can't force somebody to have trust. So if there is some sort of bad conduct, or a place has some sort of serious drawbacks, there will be a loss of confidence, loss of trust. And that's only natural. Then when we do see inspiring conduct, or we do hear teachings that will resonate with us as true, then it's also natural that there will be that sense of trust. But then there's these hindrances. So sometimes there can be doubt when we ought to trust. Sometimes there can be trust when we ought to doubt. But more often than not, perhaps there's doubt when we ought to trust. And that's when we need some wisdom. That's when we need to really use our mindfulness and discernment to see, you know, what's going on here? Can I trust this or not? And what am I looking at? How am I looking? Sometimes with very senior teachers, this happened, from what I've heard, with Longpo Cha and even Longpo Mun. It probably happened with him as well, because these legendary figures that we hear about, when they were alive, they were human beings. And they may have had mannerisms or quirks that maybe we don't know or hear much about now. But yeah, monks would find fault with Ajahn Chah. Monks would find fault with Longpo Cha. Why did he do that? I don't understand. Why was he? He seems like he's just being a really kind of fussy, way overly strict kind of, you know, people would say that about Longpo Cha. It was like when Longpo Cha came to America in 1979 and he taught a retreat at IMS, and people were really enamored with him. He saw right away that Westerners need metta. They don't need the kind of hard teaching. They needed the metta. They were being hard enough on themselves already. So us Westerners, we do tend to be overly hard on ourselves. So we need metta to be able to trust. And so he saw right away, oh yeah, they need metta. They need a lot of metta. A lot of these practitioners, they're looking really, really grim, meditating. So people tapped into that, and his metta is very strong. So that sense of really strong kindness coming from Longpo Cha. And then by the time he left, they were very sad to see him go. So he said, please stay. Please stay here longer. Teach us. We'll be your students. We'll be your disciples. And Longpo Cha said, well, you like me now, but if I were to stay, I don't think you would like me for very long. If I really started to teach you, if I really started to point at your defilements, you're not going to like it. If I really point at your defilements, if I really point at the pride and the ego and the sense of self, you're not going to like it. That's the nature of the training. But one thing he did teach them is, he said, because he was teaching teachers, these early teachers, Jack Kornfield, Sharon Salzberg, these early teachers in the West, in America. He said, you're teachers, and the difficulty of the teacher is you have to be able to pierce the heart of the student. You know, you don't want to just make them feel good. That's not what it's about. If you really want the student to progress, then you have to be able to point out the ego, uncover that hidden pride. And if you find ways to do that, that's how if they can handle it, that's how they make progress. So that's difficult. That's difficult. That's difficult to do. I want everybody to feel good. So that's what I know Longpa Pasano is able to do that with me. He didn't pull any punches, and he's able to do that with Ajahn Chunda as well. And I think Ajahn Kurudamo probably. Yeah, yeah, he was able to do it with Ajahn Kurudamo a lot, actually. And see, he's still going. He's still going. He needs surgery now, but he's still still going. So, you know, the dukkha, when we're able to face up to it, when we're able to look at our own hidden faults and really humble ourselves, that has a brightening quality. That's the mind can become very, very bright. And if we just take it easy all the time, then, as Longpo Cha said, then you become stupid. So it's good to actually push ourselves, but not without metta. So we need to push ourselves in a way, I guess you could say, find an edge, find that edge where we're developing some endurance, but we're also not really harsh and judgmental with ourselves. So the practice certainly is not to be really harsh and judgmental with ourselves. We do have to have goodwill for ourselves. If we just have harshness and a sense of being judgmental with ourselves, then it's only natural that we'll be harsh and judgmental with others. If we're kind and caring with ourselves, kind and caring in a way that we prod ourselves to practice, then it's to be expected that we'll be kind and caring with others and prodding others to practice as well. So there's these various factors to try to keep in balance. A sense of being very, very forgiving with ourselves and others. It's easy to get critical. I remember when I was in Anagarika 23 years ago, then I was really intent on practice, and I was journaling at the time. And then I journaled every day. I wrote in my journal, and I remember when the journal got full, I went and took a look at it, and I was very, very critical of myself and others in that journal. I was very, very critical, harsh, and judgmental of myself and of others. Yeah, this is, people are supposed to be practicing. What are they doing here? They're just wasting time. I'm wasting time. What am I doing here? I might as well leave. So it's just, there's no end to that. And then I actually had a certain point, I think it was around when I was 9 or 10 vasas, 9 or 10 years as a monk. And I remembered that and I thought, yeah, if I was in Anagarika at this time, or if there was somebody identical to me as I was as an Anagarika, I would be highly critical of myself now in terms of like, I would have been one of the monks I was criticizing. Put it that way. So it takes time. It takes time to see it. It takes time to see it. For me, it was going to Thailand for the first time. So for the rule here at Abhayagiri is for your third year as a bhikkhu, you get to spend 1 year away. So we spend, first 5 years as a bhikkhu is what we call nisaya or dependence. And we're supposed to be in the same monastery with the same teachers for that period, but we get a 1 year field trip so we can go to a branch monastery of our choice for that year. And I chose to go to Thailand to Wat Phanachat, and a monk named Thanajin Yanadamo was the abbot at the time. And that I also got to spend my last month of that year, I got to spend 1 month at Wat Nong Bapong with Longpa Liam. And that was very transformative for me. And I think I needed a Thai Ajahn, actually, to really see myself more clearly. And especially Longpa Liam, who is just a great bhikkhu among bhikkhus. He is somebody who, it really affected me. And it really cut through that sense of me being harsh and judgmental with myself and harsh and judgmental with others. Because here was somebody who was doing everything a bhikkhu could do in a way that there, even with my harsh and judgmental mind, I couldn't be harsh and judgmental with him. And yet he was totally at ease. So he was doing all the work. He was keeping all the precepts, doing all the work, working hard in the monastery, but also teaching and setting an example of just absolute peace and coolness and not a care in the world, not a, not, but he was dealing with things. He was dealing with many, many issues. he's the final word when it comes to the 350 branch monasteries at that time, 400 plus branch monasteries now. Longpa Liem is the final word. If there's an issue that nobody else can solve, it ends up on Longpa Liem's plate. And seeing Longpa Liem deal with issues, and it was just, I was a three Vasa young monk, just being there with Longpa Liem and seeing issues come to him. And it was almost like the crazier the issue, the more he was just delighting and letting go and not picking it up. And you, some issues that would come to him that you won't believe what this monk did. And just be like, oh yeah, that's just people. People are just, they just do that sometimes. it's almost kind of this sense of, oh, what a relief to not pick it up. What a relief to not have any worries. And just to see that, of course, it seemed very far away to being able to cultivate that type of mental state for myself. But just to see that example, it's very, very powerful. So I do feel that my first year in Thailand was very transformative for me. And when I came back to Bayagiri to finish off my Nisaya, to finish off my fourth and fifth years, I remember coming back from Thailand and I was just very quiet because I was kind of reflecting on how I was before I went to Thailand and reflecting on Longpa Liem. And I remember just thinking, wow, I really don't get it. And I really didn't get what was happening. I was really clueless. So again, another quote from Longpo Cha, he's kind of asking a bhikkhu, oh, how many years do you have now? How many vasas? And this bhikkhu says, I'm five now, I'm five vasas. He said, oh, five vasas, you have 5%. And then, so another monk who had just completed one vasa, he said, so I'm one vasa, so I have 1%. He said, no, you have 0%. He said, 0 to 5, 0%. 5, 5%. It really is like that. And it just seems to be that way for everybody. You know, it's like I did complete my fourth and fifth vasa, and then I chose to go back to Thailand for 4 more years. But after my fifth vasa, all right, I'm starting to see what's happening here. I'm starting to take notice of what's actually happening in this monastery and what we're a part of. Actually, it kind of dawned on me what we're actually a part of is really wonderful and marvelous, amazing. We're part of something that leads to coolness and peace, and we're part of a community that really wants the best for us, really rooting for us, and people who have no ulterior motives, people who really just have compassion and want to see the best for us, and that's part of their practice. Somebody asked, before I go on to for too long, I'll give a little vignette about Thanajan Mahabua, and he's this one of the, he passed away in 2011, but he's considered one of the fiercest Thai Ajahns, not pulling any punches, just really, really strong in the training and really could be very hard to live with, and considered very coarse in his speech, but also considered almost universally to be one of the greatest arhants in Thailand of the age. And he actually visited Wat Phananachat and they did a Q&A with him. And so sometimes the Farangs, the Western monks, they don't know about this quality we call Grangjai in Thai. So Thais would be really afraid to ask these questions of Ajahn Mahabua, but the Westerners are just kind of like, oh yeah, I'm just going to ask him anything I want. So one of the Westerners blurts out, what's it like to be an arhant? It's like, what's it like? And then he says, really without pausing, he says, there's only compassion. The arhant only has compassion. So that might fly in the face of some of our ideas about arhants, but he said, that's all that's left. That's all that's left is compassion. No ulterior motives, no hidden agendas, just compassion, just a wish that everybody see the Dhamma that they've seen. That's all they care about. And sometimes to get people there, it's going to take they might be harsh. If they see their student creating bad kamma and the student isn't aware of it, yeah, they're going to, it's like the child running out in front of the, into the highway, and they're going to get hit by a bus and you have to tackle that child. It might get bloodied and bruised, but you saved its life. It didn't get hit by the bus. And the child might even be angry at you because it didn't see the bus. It didn't know the bus was there. But you, nonetheless, you saved its life. So that's what these greatest of ajans, that's what they're like. That's what they're going to do for us out of compassion. Much of the time, we're not even going to realize it, that they're helping us. And we might think, yeah, you know, they're just upset because they're irritated with me and they don't like me, da 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 da. But that's not the case with somebody like Lumpur Cha or Tanaja Mahabua. That's certainly not the case. It's pure compassion. I think that's an appropriate amount of time for some reflections, just coming out of retreat and just thinking about refuge and thinking about Thailand and the Krupa Ajahns and just some of the reflections on the precepts. I think that can at least keep us going for a little while. So I'll leave it there.